WCNC Charlotte. This is Flashpoint, where power and politics collide and the tough questions get asked and answered.
Thanks for joining us here on Flashpoint. I'm Ben Thompson. The North Carolina General Assembly entering the final stretch of its legislative session. Republican leaders able to push through a lot of legislation thanks to a supermajority both in the House and the Senate. Lawmakers able to get 50 different pieces of legislation into law. That includes 12-week restrictions on abortion, legalizing mobile sports betting, and authorizing gun owners to get a permit without going through the sheriff's office. And now, one of the most powerful lawmakers in the state is here to help preview what's still to come. Joining us now is the top leader in the North Carolina Senate, Phil Berger. He's held that position for some 13 years. Senator, welcome to Flashpoint. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
All right, so with the countdown to the end of the session looming, in your mind, as the Senate leader, what is your top priority for the General Assembly?
Clearly, the top priority at this point is to get the budget taken care of and to make sure that we've addressed those funding issues that that are needed. And as part of that, to take another step as far as tax relief for the people of North Carolina.
What else has to happen with the budget? I know Medicaid expansion was tied into that, and that was a big step for not only Republicans, but also for the state of North Carolina. But I know the governor himself has expressed quite a bit of displeasure with the budget as it currently stands otherwise. What else has to happen as far as trying to find some agreement and compromise?
Yeah, so right now we've had our appropriations chairs, both the House and the Senate, working to address kind of the individual line items as far as appropriations are concerned. They also are working on what are called provisions. Those are explanatory provisions or parts of the budget that help articulate how the dollars that are being appropriated are to be administered. The big issues that are out there now is we have a fairly significant amount of what we call one-time money. That money currently is allocated to certain reserves. So, for instance, we have a water and sewer reserve. We have a transportation reserve. We have a state capital infrastructure fund that is a reserve. And so we are still working on reaching agreement with reference to exactly how much money goes into each of those reserves. And then we'll work on exactly how those reserve dollars get allocated out of that reserve. That's one of the matters that we're still trying to resolve. The other has to do with the tax package and precisely what sort of tax relief, tax policy we're going to see in the budget.
Also in the news this week, the Senate passing sweeping changes when it comes to election laws, including some changes for voter registration and deadlines for absentee ballots. I know people have said in the past it's to prevent fraud, but it seems like fraud is kind of a non-issue. However, it does strike me like that absentee ballot thing, you know, the deadline having to be, you know, election day and not 3 or 4 days later when we all have to wait around. That to me, I think, is a winning argument to a lot of folks because it just doesn't make sense of having to wait around. Is it to you a fraud issue, or is it just makes more more common sense?
Yeah, so I think it's a confidence issue. The whole thing to me is about what steps can we take to enhance the confidence that people have in election outcomes. You know, we've seen situations where in 2016 the Democrats were expressing concerns about whether or not Donald Trump actually won or Hillary Clinton won. And so in 2020, the many Republicans were concerned about and expressed doubts about whether or not the outcomes were accurate. So it's, you know, it's sort of a bipartisan thing that folks have indicated questions about elections. And so what we need to do is set up our election machinery in a way that enhances confidence, not erodes confidence. And as you said, if you have a situation where ballots keep coming in days, and at least in North Carolina, the way the Democrats on the Board of Elections did it last time, over a week after Election Day, that does not enhance confidence. And some would say, and I would tend to agree, that it has the potential to erode confidence in the outcome.
The Senate also looking to strip some power from the governor and shift it to the General Assembly when it comes to picking members of the State Board of Elections you just mentioned. I chatted with Pat McCrory last week on this show and asked him about that. I want you to take a listen to his response.
I do not support efforts to strip more power from the governor. One day, we Republicans will regret that when a new Republican gets into the governor's office. I believe in separation of powers and the authority of the executive branch to do the day-to-day operations of government at the federal level and the state level.
Is he wrong? Is this being short-sighted for next time there's Democratic control of the General Assembly?
I don't think it's being short-sighted, and I do think he's wrong. What we are doing is setting up, or at least making changes that are fully consistent with the Constitution of North Carolina. And just because a former governor or a group of former governors think that the governor's office ought to have a certain amount of power, that doesn't mean the Constitution says that. And so we believe, we'll see, because I'm sure there'll be lawsuits filed. We'll see whether or not what we are doing will be viewed by the courts as consistent. And I think it is. I think actually, if you read through the cases that generally are cited as by Governor McCrory and other governors, it is very clear that both Republicans and Democrats on the state Supreme Court have said that the power to appoint is not, under our Constitution, an executive function exclusively. And so we have multiple instances of boards that that make decisions that the governor is not the person that is in direct control.
Still come here on Flashpoint. Senator Berger weighing in on trying to find good faith compromise on deeply divisive issues like gender. Welcome back to Flashpoint. Our conversation now continues with top North Carolina Senator Phil Berger. I want to talk about school vouchers. The bill passed both the House and the Senate, now working out budget issues, I believe. Critics argue that there's not a lot of accountability in some of these private or charter schools. And unlike public schools, they can turn away students for random reasons. What do you say to those critics that say, even if they believe in these vouchers, that there needs to be more accountability if we're going to send public school students to some of these schools?
Yeah, so I believe that the best accountability is the accountability that comes with parental involvement. That parents are in a better position than anybody, better position than a bureaucrat somewhere, better position than a school superintendent somewhere, to know what's best for that parent's child. And so while I'm sympathetic to, and we're looking at options to require, or at least have administered some tests that are nationally normed, even in the private schools that receive vouchers, I don't think that's necessary to have the kind of accountability that we need. Remember, we currently have a situation as far as the traditional public schools where many people are just trapped based on the fact that they live at a particular address. And not everybody, in fact, most people don't have the wherewithal to sell their house or to move from one place to another if their child is in a school or is assigned to a school that does not meet that child's needs. And so wealthy people have always had the ability to opt out of the traditional public system, to put their child in the school that best fits their child's needs. And I think that's something that every parent should have the right to do.
A lot of folks talk about public schools failing. And I spoke to a group of teachers this past weekend. it does feel like sometimes our teachers are sometimes being set up for failure. Now, I know the teachers union is probably not one of your favorite groups, but I mean, for the average public school teacher out there, do you feel like the state has their back?
So I think the state is supportive. The state legislature clearly is supportive of teachers in the traditional public schools. I do think that in many instances, the administrative control of the public schools makes decisions that make the schools less safe for teachers, make the schools less able to have the kind of environment where learning can take place. And I think many teachers recognize that. And while we want to make sure that we pay our teachers an appropriate, fair, and competitive wage, we also need to do a better job of making sure that the environment that teachers in the public schools are working in is one that is safe for them, conducive to learning, and an environment that children will succeed in.
A current Senate bill would ban any healthcare professional in the state from providing any gender-affirming medical care to anybody under the age of 18. These interventions are very rare, and leading medical groups support them when they are necessary. But all that aside, you just said parents know best when it comes to their kids and not bureaucrats. Couldn't you make that exact same argument when it comes to parents of transgender kids looking to get the medical care they feel like their kids need?
So the question is, how absolute do you want that that to be? Do you want parents to have the absolute right to make any decision, even if it harms the child? I think we've got a long history of recognizing that in some instances, the parents are not making good decisions. In some instances, parents make destructive decisions. In some instances, parents abuse their children. And so all we're trying to do here is say that if you have a minor, that you will not have surgery on a minor that changes that minor's sex from male to female or female to male, that you will not have the administration of drugs that have the effect of impairing and inhibiting the natural growth and development of a child. Now, once a child gets to be 18, if they make a decision, they've reached the age of majority, they have the appropriate maturity to make those kinds of decisions. Adults can make those sorts of decisions. But to make that decision for a child that has that kind of permanent impact on their physical and mental health is something that that we don't think is appropriate and we think needs to be stopped.
I would still make the case that your word here, bureaucrats, no better in certain circumstances than parents, but not in others. But I will not belabor the point there. One more question on the trans community and the athletes. The Senate voted 31-17 to ban trans girls from playing sports teams that align with their gender identity. And admittedly, I think when you talk to anybody about this is a difficult topic that doesn't have a clear solution that makes all groups happy. But I mean, Have you spoken with members of the trans community about the right way to address this issue, trying to find some sort of good faith compromise here?
So there's division in our society about this issue. I've talked with female athletes who are very concerned about whether or not there's fairness in women's sports if a biological male is allowed to compete in events that involve speed or strength or size. And so I think if we want to have competitive women's athletics, if we want to have women's athletics where biological females have the ability to compete on a level playing field, then we cannot allow men to compete against them. And make no mistake about it, a transgender female is a biological male, and it's just not fair.
I want to talk about what's been accomplished when it comes to that 12-week abortion ban. Do you expect that there'll be further restrictions down the road that, that Republicans want to pass in Raleigh?
There are no further restrictions that I'm aware of that that are going to move forward in this General Assembly. Obviously, we have an election every 2 years. I don't know what the makeup of the General Assembly will be after the next election, but I certainly don't see amongst my members the number of people who would be necessary in order to pass a bill that makes further changes as far as those laws are concerned.
Your colleague over in the House, Tim Moore, involved in a bit of a scandal right now. I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on your colleague's scandal because I know you don't want to, but the whole alienation of affection thing has come up. Do you think that's an antiquated law on the books that should be changed?
I have been supportive of keeping the alienation of affections and criminal conversation torts in our law. I believe that they are things that protect or at least recognize the sanctity of a marriage, and I don't see a need to make that change.
The GOP a couple of weeks ago censuring your old colleague, Tom Tillis. Do you agree with that move?
I've never been in favor of what, for all practical purposes, would be a circular firing squad. I think we advertise the Republican Party, and I believe it is, as a big tent. I think what that means is that there are going to be times that elected officials may not agree with some members of the party. I just think that's part of what a healthy party would be. If I had been a delegate at the convention, I would not have voted in favor of that.
A final question. I know you had appeared at an event for Mark Robinson when he announced for governor. Are you planning to formally endorse him and support him in the primary?
I'm not prepared to make an endorsement at this time. I have told anyone who asks that I think Lieutenant Governor Robinson would make a very good governor. I think he's got the right talents and the right philosophical leanings to be a very good governor for the state of North Carolina.
Senate President Phil Berger. Senator, thanks for coming on. We appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Take care. A Where's the Money investigation coming up after the break. Welcome back to Flashpoint. The city of Charlotte working to fix a costly mistake. That error happened early in the pandemic and cost a local nonprofit more than $230,000. That's a lot of money for a nonprofit. That money would have helped small businesses in University City and would have gone unnoticed had WCNC Charlotte not double-checked the city's math. In direct response to Nate Morabito's investigation, the city is now working to make things right. Nate's now asking, where's the money?
At the upcoming Charlotte City Council meeting Monday, leaders are expected to approve a $230,000 grant the city should have given to University City Partners in 2020. The district's council representative told us not only is the city working to make this right, there's a better process now in place to make sure a mistake like this doesn't happen again. Nothing can stop this blood. September 2020, 6 months into a pandemic that kept people home.
The crowd is not as large as it was in the past.
Here we go.
And left small business owners fighting for survival.
I'm glad they still move forward with it.
University City Partners worked to keep Charlotte's second largest employment hub alive.
We have small businesses that are so critical.
University City Partners did its part.
They were doing great work.
Without a $237,000 grant, the city should have awarded the nonprofit.
There was a human error, and we're going to make it up to them.
Councilmember Renee Perkins Johnson and others at City Hall only learned of that error after WCNC Charlotte discovered it.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
As part of our detailed review of the city's federally funded small business support grant program, we found three other organizations that secured a combined $430,000 in grants despite scoring lower on their applications, eventually blamed on a human error in calculation when adding up the score sheets.
I'm the biggest cheerleader for District 4.
Perkins Johnson sits on University City Partners' board and says she advocated for the nonprofit once she found out about the city's mistake.
What do you want the taxpayers to know?
I want them to know that I ran on public accountability, and I'm consistently fighting for that. So that's important to me. That's important to all of council. And we're going to make this right.
Perkins Johnson says while the organizations that received the money still use the funds for the right purpose of sustaining small business, city staff have assured her there are additional checks and balances in place.
We're going to have more than two people now reviewing those numbers
to make sure public dollars are better protected in the future. So where's the city finding the extra money to correct this error? The plan is to use federal dollars through the American Rescue Plan Act. Nate Morabito, WCNC Charlotte.
More Flashpoint after this. Welcome back to Flashpoint, folks. Come interact with us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. We're there. If there's something you want us to talk about here on Flashpoint, somebody you want us to interview, let us know. And as always, remember to listen and subscribe to our podcast. You can find it wherever you get yours. And we'll see you back here next weekend.